Well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
A couple of people have asked me, what do you mean when you say awakening in another person? And according to Rudolf Steiner, that is the real goal of the esoteric work. And so I thought that today, tomorrow's the last day, that today I would take a look at that because it really is a key to what Rudolf Steiner calls consciousness soul. And in his work, he has seen that there are certain stages of development that all of humanity has gone through. And consciousness soul is a later stage of development. And the way he characterizes it is that consciousness soul is incredibly antisocial. And the reason why it's antisocial is because in consciousness soul, everyone will realize that they are a unique individual person with complete freedom. And that can be very antisocial. That can be very devastating. It's sort of Dennis Rodman, I'm as bad as I want to be. If everybody was like that. If everybody was, I'm as bad as I want to be, I'm in your face, you can't say nothing about it, tough for you. That is the shadow side of consciousness soul. And yesterday, I characterized certain forces, but I didn't actually name them. What I've been doing is paralleling some indications that Steiner gave about when a person begins to undertake inner work, they have to go down inside their own consciousness, and they have to fight what he called beasts down there. They have to deal with shadow elements that are particularly unsavory. And he named these beasts that everyone has to face. And the second lecture I gave was about one beast, and that is paralysis in the thinking, or paralysis in the will, and that is fear. So when I'm paralyzed in my will and I can't do anything, that's the characteristic of fear. And fear, Rudolf Steiner has said, is a kind of beast that lives in the center of the soul that has to be overcome if I wish to develop myself. So one of the lectures I devoted to the question of fear, paralysis of the will. And then doubt is the paralysis in the realm of thinking. This is when I can't tell the difference between a fact and an image, or between a being and an image. That's doubt. And in doubt, I can't actually come to a conclusion with my thinking because I just keep thinking all kinds of different strange things. And that's a beast that lives in my soul that I have to overcome if I wish to become truly human. And then yesterday, I addressed the third beast, or this third problem in the soul, and that's a problem in the feeling. And Rudolf Steiner characterizes it as mocking, or what he calls hatred. So the tendency to mock others is actually a form of hatred, and everyone has it as the root of a kind of feeling when they become an individual and they live in consciousness soul. When they actually experience their true freedom, they find themselves separated from everyone else, and everyone else looks a little less than wonderful. And when they see everyone else, what they feel like saying is, you know, if you only did this, you would be a lot cooler. Or if you only did this, you'd be a little closer to the way I think the world should be. And that is, in its devilish form, mocking, or what Rudolf Steiner calls hatred. You can use either of those two words. Now, yesterday we did an exercise where I asked you to present what you thought this thing in your hands was to somebody else. Now, and then we did, maybe it's time for a female president, and you presented that to somebody else. And then the day before that, I had the line that sort of could be a triangle or not. There are a lot of questions around that. Some people felt it was ambiguous. And I say, absolutely, it's ambiguous. Because the purpose of the work I'm trying to share with you is to build a tolerance for ambiguity without resorting to fear, doubt, or mocking. In the ancient world, the alchemists understood the value of ambiguity was to make me stronger as an individual. If I can face ambiguity in myself without succumbing to doubt, fear, or mocking, I have a gift in my soul that becomes a kind of leaven for other people. Rudolf Steiner gives the picture. The individual human life is not lived for the individual human, but for everyone else. We think because we come in and we have a life and it's given to us that we're living it for ourselves. But indeed, we're actually living it for other people. And what we overcome in our own individual life becomes a kind of tincture or a yeast for others to be able to overcome. This is the great esoteric law. The great teachers would overcome something in their own inner life, and out of that it became possible for other people to overcome that. Not through what they taught, but through who they were. Through what they had overcome. It becomes a kind of potential in the group consciousness that allows other people to say to themselves, maybe I can overcome that in myself. This is why I've been taking the tack. I have been trying to say, you can overcome these things. And when you do, you become a teacher for someone else to overcome the same thing. But you have to work to face doubt and fear and mocking in your own soul in order to have the capacity to overcome it. So what doubt and fear and mocking represent in the soul is ambiguity. You can't tell what is true or not. That's doubt. You can't tell whether or not tomorrow I will get what I want or not. That is fear. You can't tell whether the person who you're dealing with gets where you're coming from or not. That's mocking or hatred. And every time you come upon a new something for yourself that's a kind of a gift for you or an insight, the urge is to share that with someone else. And the way the world is designed is as soon as you share it, someone else says, thank you for sharing, but we have a bunch of that in the back room already. And this is the experience of the three-year-old child sitting at the dinner table saying, I saw a cloud that looked like a giraffe today. And the answer is, well, it's just a cloud. Thank you for sharing. But we have enough of that kind of strangeness in the world. So what the child does is says, I guess what I'm bringing is not worth it. So I'm going to have to find some way to express what I'm doing in my life in order to get the recognition from this person that I love and respect so that I can feel like I'm a real human. And so they adjust what they're doing and take on what's known as, in psychology, a persona, a personality. And the persona is from the Latin per, through, sona, to sound, to speak. A persona is a mask that they used in the theater with a hole cut out that the actors would speak through. They had a little megaphone in it. That's a persona. It's a mask. And it's a mask of who I really am as a being who's lived for all eternity. The Native Americans said that the human being is a limitless, omnipotent, and omniscient being. Comes from a star and visits the earth. And the purpose of visiting the earth is to learn the one thing that we don't know, being omniscient and omnipotent, and that is a sense of limitation. So we come to earth as star beings to learn limitation, and our teachers are the people who are sitting next to us. They teach us the limitation of what I'm holding in my soul may not be what you are holding in your soul. And that's the beginning of doubt and fear and mocking. And then over time, hopefully, a person gets to a spot where they say, I have to change this. So when I decide to change my thinking, that in the ancient world was called metanoia. It's a very deep and profound experience when a person decides that they want to change the way they're thinking about something. If they can succeed in doing that, then that allows someone else who they might not even know to change their thinking. If I can overcome my fear at scarcity and express gratitude to someone I don't even really know, that makes it possible in the larger scheme of things for other people to be able to express gratitude to people that they don't really know. This will, in the future, be the basis of the social ethic. You will have to do things. You will have to be responsible when you choose a job for the implications of that job on the environment and on the social fabric. That's what we heard in that pledge the other day. This is new. This is a new deal. This has not really been part of the way cultures have been working for a long while, especially en masse. You could find it in an ashram. You could find it in a temple somewhere where a group of people got together and decided that they were going to try to live that way in the satsang or in the sangha. People could do that. They could live with each other in harmony, each working for the other. But you had the Roshi and the guy with the stick in case you decided that maybe you didn't want to go along with the rules. But the new deal is the Roshi and the guy with the stick and the person that's climbing over the back wall to get a glass of wine after lights out are all the same person. And that person is you. You are all of those because you are a consciousness that has many incarnations of memories embedded in the way in which you live in the world. And so the task in a new age, which we are now in, is to find how can my individuality and the choices I make as an individual somehow inform the possibility of a more enlightened collective? How can that happen? Is it possible? Or will it always be the threat of what Rudolf Steiner called the war of each against all? Because the shadow threat of consciousness soul is that everyone will decide, to hell with you, I'm just going to act towards getting what is best for me. I'm just going to express my doubt. I'm going to express my fear. I express my mocking and my hatred in any way that I see fit because I'm free to do so. This is the dire implication of the philosophy of freedom. That's the shadow. But on the positive side, it's possible for an individual to awaken to the fact that we're all connected inwardly in our consciousness directly to each other. And if I decide to walk that path, I have to go down and face doubt and fear and mocking in my own soul and dialogue with them. I have to say, how is it with you in my soul, doubt? How is it with you in my soul, fear? Why do I have the tendency to mock or to hate? I don't really hate, but I don't think I like your shoes or whatever. And that's a subtle form. It's called casting down. And Rudolf Steiner gives a picture that for every person that develops, there are other beings that get cast down. For every saint that develops, There's a whole group of people that get cast down and are retarded as a kind of sacrifice for this one to move ahead. And so the rule in the esoteric work is, if you've been fortunate enough to have the karma to move ahead, you have the responsibility to serve those who've been cast down because of your development. This is what is arising as a global consciousness now all over the third world, along with the shadow side of the gods must be crazy, here's a Coke bottle, I'll end up hitting you in the head with it, if you've seen that movie. It's a wonderful movie, Gods Must Be Crazy. So in the world of the future, which you will inherit from gray hairs like me when I'm pushing up daisies somewhere, you are going to have to deal with the problem of how what I do in my own inner life affects the global consciousness. And I have to have that intact before I start acting globally, or I'm just spreading my little version of doubt, fear, and mocking around in the world. And I'm calling it the new way or something. And then all you people down there, you better get out of my way because I need this to do my thing and you're in my way, and so I'll put you down and there you are. I've labeled you, you're now ADD. And so because you're ADD, I give you this little substance and you go over there on Group W bench and you hang out because you're not as cool as I am. Or maybe you're the Ritalin guy or whatever. But you've lost some of your humanity because I have developed. Yeah? This is, in a nutshell, consciousness soul. And this is the reason why I've been trying to kind of be a little ardent here, because it is my problem, but as I said, you know, in whatever, Lord, I don't know, you know, how long I'm on the planet, I'll have to deal with it. But you people are going to have to pick up the tab. And you are going to have to decide that you've had enough somewhere. And when you decide you've had enough, the question is, are you going to go throw the brick through the jewelry store window, or are you going to negotiate, get your facts straight, purify, and then act without violence? That's the question. And Rudolf Steiner called it consciousness soul. Right? It's a very big issue. So if you want to have a study group and you want to do something productive for yourself, take a look at what the issue, what the shift is between intellectual soul or mind soul and consciousness soul. It has a lot to do with the destiny of America. A lot to do with the destiny of the beings that have a lot of wealth. A lot of opportunities. Because that requires great bodhisattva energy to overcome the casting down that happens as a natural part of having privilege. It's sort of a shadow around the neck of the American dream. But it's very productive because it keeps us awake and working and developing. So I'd like to read to you a few quotes about this. And the first is, there's a term called moral hazard. And moral hazard has to do with the insurance industry. And the insurance industry understands that when there is no crisis, nobody makes extravagant claims. Everybody can pretty much, if they make a claim, it's pretty much in the ballpark. But as soon as there's a crisis, where there's a social chaos, where the rules kind of get superseded a little bit, then the insurance agents have a special training course they go through called moral hazard. And it's actually written into your insurance policy. A moral hazard is a term that is used by economists to describe the tendency for individuals or organizations to calculate risks and benefits to their own advantage instead of calculating them for the good of the whole. This is an insurance term. When a crisis unfolds and pressure on the system begins to create stress, the forces of moral hazard come into play. When crises arise, insurance policyholders often claim significant damage to their goods because it's chaos and nobody's really going to check. So if I pad it a little bit, what the heck? It's owed to me because of all the suffering I've done. And now the key here is also individuals in a group of demonstrators who are the most disgruntled are often the first ones to pick up the first brick to throw into the jewelry store window. So what happens when there is crisis or where there's stress is groups will form with initiatives. But the energy of the group goes to the lowest common denominator of who is most disgruntled or who expects to get more kickback from the fact that chaos is ensuing. So always initiatives are infiltrated by people that have another agenda to create chaos and wreak havoc. And then you're walking down the street in a demonstration, and the guy next to you picks up a brick and throws it through a jewelry store window and starts grabbing jewelry. And suddenly, 27 cops show up, shoot some tear gas, and are clubbing you down to the ground when you were there because you were part of the Daughters of the American Revolution or something. But suddenly, your initiative has become co-opted by someone else who had didn't have the same kind of view on what is known as moral hazard. This is just a little bit of a picture of the way in which good intentions get twisted and thrown out when people organize to get things done. So I'd like to now read you a quote from Rudolf Steiner about the great law of how to deal with moral hazard. There's a certain great law that governs the progressive development of consciousness in all future stages of life. He's talking about consciousness, soul. Namely, one's own development occurs through what one does to help others attain an enhanced consciousness. In consciousness, soul, your development doesn't pertain to your own inner work. It pertains to how much time you spend helping other people develop their consciousness. And in the end, the love you take is equal to the love you make. Okay? And that could be the little anthem of the new consciousness instead of background for Chris Bliss's juggling. If you've seen that little blog thing. So this anthem is, I am responsible for helping you lift your consciousness. That's consciousness soul. And if I try to do that, the first thing I run into is I may not have done it myself for myself. So before I can lift your consciousness, I have to at least try to lift my own. And the first thing I run into when I try to lift my own is doubt and fear and mocking. So it's a difficult problem, but it's not impossible. It just means that I have to begin. And the best place to begin is to understand that there is a very fundamental practice that is the root of all these things I'm speaking about, and that is learning to awaken in the other. Learning to awaken in the other does not mean that you have to agree with what the other person is thinking or doing. It simply means that you need to practice awakening in them so that if you don't agree with them, you can do something inside you to pray for them and to get yourself in a right place so that you're not contributing to their delinquency. So that you're not creating more energy that keeps them locked into their negative pattern. Puts the responsibility on you to awaken in them so that you can at least resonate a little bit with how it is with them. How is it with you? Or, as Parsifal said, what ails thee, uncle? Parsifal is the first consciousness soul being. with the first and only consciousness soul question. What ails thee? How can I help you out of the dilemma that you're in? This is the significance of that book written so long ago, is that it was pointing way to the future. Way to the future. To a consciousness that we can't even imagine yet what it would be if we actually had the attitude that we were helping each other by working on myself. So Parsifal helped Amfortas by having Trevor Zent help him lift his consciousness. And how did Trevor Zent do it? By asking him questions. Do you understand what happened when you did this? Can you help me understand? I've got a problem with what happened here, and I think you need to look at it. So remember when this happened? Well, do you know what happened when that happened? He didn't say, you're bad. He said, do you know what happened when this happened? So the technique is not to make statements, to tell a person they're wrong, to tell a person they're stupid or something, but to ask a question that helps the other person lift their consciousness to maybe a better solution. And you find this is child, how to speak to your children as if you want to be heard, and all these things in the mainstream. This is active listening, what I hear you saying. This is nonviolent communication. These are all these things that are rising in the mainstream that basically are anthroposophically oriented things by people who are the best anthroposophists ever and never even heard the word. Because anthroposophy has to move out of the Anthroposophical Society and move in the world, the big world, and change things. The big world, and not act as if it's the only place where it's happening. Rudolf Steiner said there will be millions of anthroposophists. They just might not call themselves that. So the question is, can we develop an inner vision to recognize this particular thread that I'm trying to focus on here, consciousness, soul? And Marshall Rosenberg is dealing with this problem. Big time. Yeah? Conflict resolution. How can we do it? That's a consciousness soul problem. Okay? Martin Luther King, Gandhi, Thoreau, his night in jail. Yeah? Civil disobedience without violence. But there are techniques and there are processes. There are things that need to be developed in a particular way so that you're not just projecting doubt and fear and mocking out on the world. You have to try to tame that a little bit in yourself. So the best way to do that is to find another person and to try to seek what we could call dialogue. So on the board here, there's a process of dialogue. And if you're interested in this in a deeper way, on the table in the office are some of these. These are little flyers for Koros Institute. It's an institute we have to teach dialogue techniques. And I have a few more here if you're interested in that. We have regular meetings where we have problems that we bring into the world, or we bring people that have solved problems, entrepreneurs. We've worked with prison outreach. We've worked with geriatric care. We've worked with Save the River people. We've worked with entrepreneurship, people doing socially developed programs in Oakland and whatever. We've had a lot of different programs. And in all of them, the basis is, can we learn how to speak to each other as if we were really interested? That's Koros Institute. So if you're interested, here's some flyers, or there's some on the table. Or how many people have been to Koros events here? Yeah, so if you've been to a Koros event or you're interested, just talk to some of these people who've raised their hand, because it's aimed at trying to have a perception of what this work is in consciousness soul. So, awakening in the other. If I make a statement to you, you must surrender to my statement. or you stay within yourself. If you stay within yourself, I get the message that I wasn't heard. So I will probably make my statement a little stronger. And if you still don't surrender, then I go into doubt, fear, and mocking. Yeah? That's generally the way the pattern is. I'll give you two shots to be on, you know, in line with me. And if I find you're not, then I give you the blast. And so that kind of energy comes from statements. Now, in my work in Sacramento, every Thursday, we have a meeting that I, in my own mind, I call the Crucible, and where we begin by only asking questions for 10 minutes about pictures that are totally ambiguous. I bring in pictures and I hand them out, and we sit there and we ask questions about ambiguous pictures, and people are going like, what the hell is this supposed to be? What is, you know, this is weird. This is stupid. And I've been in some of the discussion groups, and when they do questions only, you can see some people going like, what is this? Well, the purpose of that is to bring up the idea that what happens when there is a question that is unanswered? What do I supply into the space when there is an unanswered question? Do I put doubt, fear, or mocking into the place when a question is unanswered? And the purpose of extending that for 10 minutes is so you can watch what particular brand comes up today. Which one comes up the back stairs and says, well, that was a stupid question. That's mocking. Yeah? So in that practice of questions only, there's a kind of tension built. And the reason why I use ambiguous figures is so that there's greater tension built. If I gave you a figure that meant something or a picture that meant something, somebody would know the answer and they go, this is what it means. And then the energy of trying to pull out from each other this kind of interest in the question rather than the answer would die. As soon as somebody makes a statement, oh, I know what that is, then it dies. But if the question stays open, people get a little nervous and a little anxious, especially if the figure or the image is ambiguous or the thing is like, well, I can't really tell what that is. But that is a training for hearing something come to you that is exactly opposite to what you believe. So you may have a personal belief that you have, that you've worked on, and you have a lot of facts behind it. And then you put that out in the world. And then the first thing that comes back is doubt or fear or mocking about what you've put out. And then you are forced to go back on yourself and somehow change, instead of the doubt, fear, and mocking generating more doubt, fear, and mocking, you have a choice. You can choose to not go there and to pick a particular picture or an inner process that stabilizes you. And the best inner picture that would stabilize you is to actually be able to understand why the other person has doubt, fear, or mocking. That's the purpose of awakening in another. It's possible to do that. It's possible to stop your own reaction and to change your will so that you will yourself to say, if I was in this situation that this person is in, can I imagine the feelings that they're having? Now, you may not agree with the feelings, but at least by the very fact that you have entered into their feelings in a conscious way, in the spiritual realm, you've changed something in the relationship. And I can tell you, sometimes it's the only thing that works is going into the other person's space and trying to see what ails the uncle. How did it get to this position with you? Now, if you can find a place to do this, and you can manage to do it with a person that there's a stuck place with, you may have a dream. Or someone else may come and tell you a biographical element about the person that suddenly gives you a big hit of how it must be like to be them, that allows the energy that is where the tension is to be resolved. And you may find then that that person, it becomes a benefactor or a confidant. I've had experiences in my own life where I've had people who were definitely a kind of enemy of my own, and we were struggling with each other very strongly, to the point of some pretty heavy accusations, and I was forced up against the wall with this person and ended up finding this principle of just praying for them out of desperation. And within a week, the relationship shifted. And now that person is actually on the other side of the threshold, and I feel is a benefactor for me. The person actually called me before they passed away and apologized for something they said 25 years previously. Now, this is possible in consciousness soul, because we now have the capacity as individuals to get a hold of our own inner life and to transform it in productive ways. So rather than making a statement about an ambiguity that we sense, well, I don't get it, I think you're wrong, we make a question. And the question is, I don't understand, rather than you are wrong. And the simple shift of energy to ask a question rather than make a statement enables the other person to move in a certain direction towards you, because they sense that you're not attacking. You've taken the violence out. And this is the fourth level, act without violence. The third level, purification, is when I decide to ask a question rather than make a statement. That's a purification, because I do a giveaway of my urge to make the statement and to finally settle this thing once and for all and punch the other person in the head psychically. I've decided to not do that. And I awaken in what it would be like to be them, I don't have to accept their viewpoint. So it's not like I want to be everybody else and become vulnerable to what they think and whatever. Then I lose myself. That's not good. But if I can't tolerate awakening in them a little bit, then I have just said, you are not worth my time as a human being. Which is each against all. It's the big war. So Cindy Sheehan, and yesterday I read a little quote from her, she realized through Thich Nhat Hanh that she was creating worse energies by condemning the Bush energy than by trying to somehow understand it. And that's consciousness soul. This is a symptom of a new kind of consciousness that will be with us for a long time. This is sort of the best it gets here as humans. Sort of the latest upgrade, and everything else is just going to be, you know, just bells and whistles, but this is the real deal. Consciousness soul. You buy this package and no other upgrade is going to make it obsolete. Okay, so here's the technique. I give some information and I try to make sure that my facts are straight. Then I have to move into negotiation or discussion. And negotiation simply means that I need to listen to your facts without coming back with my own facts. It doesn't mean I lose my own facts, but it just means I decide to listen to your facts. And if I really want to make this really keen, I go past the facts, the images, the stuff, and try to listen to the being. Right? This is where I'm going. I've been talking about it all along, but how do I listen to a being? Well, I'll give you a picture, and Ron's probably going to have fun with this one, but this is, and it comes right from Rudolf Steiner, and that is, learn to look at the back of your own head. And you think that's a silly thing until you try to develop it as a practice. And what you'll find is if you can develop it as a practice, when there is some heat coming out at you from somebody, if you practice in the morning just trying to see the back of your head, and you just do it and form it and then dissolve it and form it and then it moves on, eventually, when the heat comes on, that's where you go when you get confronted by someone. You kind of sneak out the back and go, you can shoot this corpse down here because that's not me. But if you practice going there consciously, when the heat comes on and you start to pull out an excornate, it's a familiar place to be. You're okay there. You're still intact. You know what to do. You have some power over what is going to come out of la boca grande. Which is very cool in certain situations. Yeah? So it sounds strange, but Rudolf Steiner mentions it in a few places and a few people pick it up, but it's a very valuable practice. Because when it really means something and someone is either bringing doubt, fear, or mocking on you, and you start to excarnate, if you have a place to go that you've practiced going there, you can move from discussion to conversation. If you can't get a hold of your soul, you go into reaction, and then it's the war of each against all. Then it's they win, or you win, or you win, or they win, or they win, or you win. They're right, you're wrong, you're right, they're wrong. Doubt, fear, mocking. But if you can manage to have just a little space between what they say and your reaction to it, which is what I've been describing all week, is how to create that little space. If you have that little space, you can practice asking a question rather than making a statement. And very often, if you ask a question when somebody's bringing heat, then they have the sense that they were heard, which is basically all they want. They may know that their opinion is half-baked, which is why they're probably saying it increasingly loud, in loud terms, yeah? There's an old saying, empty barrels make the most noise. So if someone just keeps upping the energy of what they're doing, you're pretty much guaranteed that they're running out of something in the bottom of the barrel. They're scraping the bottom of the barrel. And when they get there, that's when people get desperate. That's when chaos ensues. That's when moral hazard becomes an issue. That's when somebody throws a brick through the window. And when that happens, the time for negotiation and conversation is past. Then we're just back into the fact of who was on the street when the brick was thrown. So the techniques that we've been working with here, the silly things, you know, the rock, paper, scissors, are so that you can see that in situations where the status quo is threatened, there is a being who lives in you who is always present saying, this is what's happening now. We just want to strengthen that being by being aware of how that being reacts in various situations to various people, because the people around us are the greatest teachers of this. We're in the world for others. Our own individual consciousness is being acted on, developed by others. See if I can find that. Oh, here it is. This is Novalis. The heart is the key to life and the world. If our life is as precarious as it is, it is so in order that we should love and need one another. From the fact of our own insufficiency, we become open to the intervention of another, and it is this intervention which is the goal of life. So our vulnerability makes us human, and that's what we all have in common. And we act as if it's what we don't have in common because we're not supposed to be vulnerable, quote unquote. Yeah? So what this is consciously practicing being vulnerable to the other without losing myself. Can I do that? Well, I have to practice the surrender. And the way I do that, the most effective way to do that, is I see the back of my head, and then I decide to ask a question couched in the terms, I'm not really clear about what you just said. Could you say it in another way? Now, you may be raging inside. You may want to be punching this person up and down the azalea bushes. But if you have a little space to stop and you ask the question, then you are a representative of Parsifal. How is it with you? Can you help me understand what you're saying? We could call that the bodhisattva. I give up my own answer to try to help you with my question get to a clearer space. So we're going to practice this now with each other. And I mentioned it yesterday. Your statement is, these are two facts about global warming. This and this. And you say that to your partner. Now, your partner's task is to try to lift to the Parsifal space, to consciousness soul. So you may be saying things that they think are absolute balderdash, that are just totally uninformed, silly things based on some opinion you heard on a talk radio show. And if they load their cannon with the fact that absolutely refutes this silly thing that you're saying, then we have the war of each against all. But if, when the person says what they say, you can ask the question, I'm not clear about this. I heard you say this. How do you see that? Have you ever done this, or have you ever been here, or how do you know that? Can you help me understand that? That is the Parsifal gesture, and hopefully the other person will get a sense that they're being heard, but maybe they're not being as clear as they could be. And what's happening then is you're giving up the development of your own consciousness to help them enhance their consciousness. And paradoxically, that helps you develop your consciousness. Because in consciousness soul, We are all each other's teachers. The age of the big hotshot teacher is over. We have to be teachers for each other. So, find a partner. Your task is, these are two truths about global warming, and see if you can have a conversation. Well, there was certainly some buzz on that one. So this is between you and the other person. Now this is, we're up here, you and I. We're in the realm of dialogue. And dialogue means I need to approach you without an agenda. I need to approach you without already a preconceived expectation in order that you get the feeling that I'm really there for you. That's dialogue. Conversation is conversare, means making poetry with each other. Yeah? And discussion, this is Pluto, the god of the underworld, and cuss from Scuteri, chop into little pieces. So in discussion, I take what you say, chop it into little pieces, and send it to hell. And you can bake pretzels there, you know, like the Italians say. Go to hell and bake pretzels. It's a wonderful Italian curse. Yeah, so that's discussion. So there are levels of interest and rapport that we can actually help each other to move through if we're interested in the possibility of meeting another person. If we just want the facts, then we just get the facts. That's fine. Get the facts straight. Then, if I need to negotiate, fine. I need to understand that discussion allows the facts to kind of bang into each other and rearrange themselves. That's also fine. So if I need discussion, I'm at discussion, great. But if I really want to move beyond just the facts and discussion and process, I have to try to separate the facts that a person has from the being and what they're feeling. I have to try to separate those two things out in my own self. There's a certain stage of development if you do this kind of work. And I remember in my life it lasted about 3 years where I would go to lectures and I could hear from one side of a speaker's mouth what they were saying and from the other side of their mouth what they meant. And they were often not the same thing. And I stopped going to lectures because I didn't know which one to listen to. And it got me very confused. And then it started happening with just people that I was meeting. I would hear them speak, and then I would hear their feelings at another level that were often counter to what they were saying. I've talked to young people that already have this without any inner work. And it's a kind of curse that they have. Yeah? And this is a symptom that we're all crossing the threshold. We're all in another place where the stuff we think we're hiding isn't hidden. And that's a scary place. But what I'm trying to share with you is, can we prepare ourselves to be ready to live in a world like that? If we don't prepare ourselves, then we get very confused, and then where that eventually leads, that gift, so to speak, eventually leads, is the ability in yourself to say, is what I'm saying really an expression of my feelings, or is it just a schmooze kind of BS factor? Because there's a great rule in this work, and that is, what goes around comes around. And that's then karma and kama loka. So tomorrow, what I'd like to do is address this problem, now that we have a kind of a background of where dialogue could go, How can you solve problems yourself when you have to deal with this stuff just in your own soul? You don't have another person to bounce it off of. How can you do that? There are ways to do that. Rudolf Steiner has given tremendous pictures for stabilizing consciousness so that we can become spiritual warriors. So that's the subject for tomorrow. Thank you. All right, good question. They actually point to the same thing, and that is Rudolf Steiner uses this term, motive. He says, motive is the force of the will in the level of the ego. So in the, and that in the soul life, where I'm kind of caught in me and you and we're polar to one another, that force in that level of my being is desire. So when I see the motive for my desire, that is a purification of my desire. So if I'm in conversation with you, or if I'm in interaction with you, and I see that there is something I want to say that's going to be a real big put down on you, or it's going to just, I'm finally going to get to the bottom of this and finish this off, and I stop and ask myself, what is the motive for me, for this kind of feeling or energy in me? What is the motive? What I'm doing is purifying. I'm asking a question. Yeah? But if I can see the motive, usually the motive is, and I said it earlier, the same I have with my sandwich, which is, I win, you lose. So that motive comes out of a deep gift that I have of wisdom, because part of me lives in nature, where I must overcome certain things in the world in order to live. But then when I transfer that to my relationship to you, that becomes problematic. I have to overcome you in order to live with you. How do you feel about that? Not so good, right? So that's at another level. So as I start to see the motive for what I'm about to say, the emotional motive, emotive, there's a force in me, a motive force in me, and I have to stop and say, what is my motive for saying this, or doing this, or making this happen? What is my motive? If I can see it in the beginning, usually it's like the song a couple years ago, I see your R and it's ugly. That's how I look to myself. I see my aura and it's ugly. It's because it's filled with motives which are not pure. That's fear, doubt, and mocking. And if I stop and look at that and I decide that I'm going to give away for myself this, I have to win this, to try to listen to how you are, then I've purified my motive for in that interaction. And I can do a giveaway of my answer in order to help you with your question. That's just all a teacher does. A really good teacher, they may know the answer, but they're more interested in you getting it than in them giving it to you. So it's the teachers who pull it out of you that you remember. They can have tons more that they know that they're not saying to you, would overwhelm you, and they take an interest in the fact that they want to pull from you something that's unique to you to get an insight about something. That's all really basically this is. A teacher has to have a different motive to be in a conversation than somebody who's simply supplying facts. Different motive. So they're both the same thing. It's just that when I see my motive, that's my inspiration for giveaway. So what's in between, motive has a lot to do with the will. The doubt is in the thinking realm. But what connects the two is how I feel about this. So I may have doubt, and I get paralyzed in my thinking, doubt. Doubt usually means it could be this, or it could be that, or it could be this, or it could be that. That's doubt. It's this, and well, no, maybe it's this. You just keep coming up with stuff. Then, behind that, I have a feeling like, why do I always doubt? That's a judgment on myself that's connected to a feeling. Can you feel that?
Right.
Yeah. So behind the doubt, if you could find the, quote, right answer, yeah, suppose that you were doubtful about something that was a right, that had a definite answer. Well, you would get the right information and plug it in, and then you'd have the right answer. But usually the doubt is about stuff that I could do or couldn't do. That's tomorrow we're actually going to look at that. We're going to look at what happens, because you're young people, you're making life choices, you're going to go somewhere. How do you make a life choice and allow a process to happen without just locking and then going, oh man, I should have, oh yeah, I could have, but I would have, you know, ugh, that.
That's exactly what I'm...
Yeah. Those, the shoulda...
yeah,
right. The shoulda, coulda, woulda is not a thought. It's feelings. Shoulda means there's a voice in me that says, you blew it again, bozo. You should have done this. Well, I could have done this, you know, if I only was a better person, I could have, or if I'd only known, I would have. Those are feelings about myself. I called them core beliefs earlier. And that's really the root of the oscillation in the thinking. So in the six basic exercises, three of them have to do with feeling: equanimity, positivity, and open-mindedness. I've been talking about equanimity, positivity, and open-mindedness all week. Because those are treasures. If you can have equanimity when you're being attacked, if you can be positive when things are hitting the fan, if you can be open-minded when you're sure somebody else is wrong, then you've solved a lot of having to do with doubt and fear. That's where we're going tomorrow. That is a consciousness soul question. And it's perfectly put. And the way you said it was nature. So we heard about nature earlier. In nature, the rule is that there's wisdom. And the wisdom is something is a food for something else. Some entity is a food for some other entity. And that's in us. That's I must win over my sandwich or else I have indigestion. I know it's a silly thing, but it's actually fundamental. Your cells say to your blood, give me the good stuff, I'm going to dump the junk into you. Take it away, it's not in my backyard. That's what your cells say to your blood, is give me the good stuff, here's the poop. And on up, 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 up. Yeah, give me the good stuff. And so, and that's very wise, because everything becomes food for everything else and everything works in a very wise way. And then you get humans in that. And they start saying, well, you're not going to eat me, Jack, because I'm going to make this thing called a bow and arrow, and you can't even get near me because I'm going to put you down. It's not a fang or a claw or something. I have to engage you, really. I can go wham, and you're over there, and you don't even know what hit you. Yeah? So that's a picture. And it's a picture of a part of the human that's not natural. And you said it very clearly. It's not natural. But that part that's not natural is the part that has the potential to become very spiritualized. Native Americans understood that. They understood they had to transcend the totem, not be the totem. And when they did, they became a star person. And then they had to shepherd and be a steward for the earth and guard it, because the earth is the weak one. And we have to love it. Because that's basically, that's a statement.
Asking the person what their motive is.
Yeah. Because in this whole thing is, who owns the misunderstanding? That's where the feelings are. So if I say to you, what's your motive? I'm really saying, I'm suspect of your motive.
Well, you have to ask it
gently. Oh, okay, well, I'll write that in. We'll write it somewhere. See, but it's really what we're talking about is tone. So I could say, well, gee, you know, I'm really interested. What's your motive for that? But if I say, well, what's your motive for that? Then what you're getting from me is, I hear your motive and it's ugly. It's not where I am, and I'm checking cards and I want to know what it is. So it's a question, what's your motive? But behind it is, well, what's your motive for asking me what's my motive? Yeah, and that is where this other thing, speaking out of two sides and all, that's where, I mean, I don't know if what I experience there is just me, but I meet young people that already have it, and like I said, it's kind of a curse. But if the whole world ever gets to that place, go out in the woods for a while. Because, wow, it is very crazy making. And in the ancient world, they called it the Tower of Babel. Everybody was speaking their own thing. And the healing of that is Whitsun, where I speak my own thing, but you hear it in your own language. And we have to change the Tower of Babel to Whitsun. So we do that by being in tune with what the feelings are around all of this. I mean, I hate to keep going back to feelings because I know they're kind of mushy and whatever. But this is really the work, is can I make my feelings clear and strong and present them to you without doing violence to you? This is really the work. Tomorrow I have some really choice quotes from Martin Luther King about that, so. That's very precise. So what I hear you saying is this what you mean to say? And if it's not right, they correct it. And if it is right, then they say, oh, I see, I can't get away with that anymore.
Yeah, and then even repeating back to them what they said, is that what you said?
Yes.
They will then go, oh, no, because they will get
right.
It off.
That's right. This is called active listening, right, or nonviolent communication. There are a lot of models for this in the world. But what I'm trying to do is put it into an anthroposophical context so we can make sense out of something like Parzival. Parzival is just this work. If you actually read the conversations in Parzival, you'll hear this kind of language.